Welcome back, everybody. We hope you had a happy holidays and are off to a great start this new year. And we are pleased to once again welcome you to this month's edition of JOS Unplugged, the official podcast of the Yellow Journal of the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons. I think we have an awesome episode for you today, as we do every month. We have a really great interview for you this month with Dr. Brian Lau from Duke University, who he and his colleagues wrote a really fascinating article titled Evolution of Management of Ankle Instability in Athletes. And we have a really great discussion about the pathology of ankle instability in the population of athletes that Dr. Lau and his colleagues are treating and kind of how the management of these issues has changed and improved over the last few years and is really kind of a hot issue in orthopedics of how we're getting these people back to play sooner and overall improving outcomes. So I think you'll really enjoy that. And then as we always do, we'll review a couple articles from the January 1st and January 15th edition of the Yellow Journal, the first of which will be Demographics and Clinical Presentation of Early Stage Leg Calf Perthes Disease, a Prospective Multicenter International Study. That was certainly enlightening and a very well done study. We'll also review Staying Out of Trouble with Intramedullary Nailing of Distal Tibia Fractures, which is a follow-up to an article that was a similar technique article written by Dr. Christopher Lee and colleagues about proximal tibia fracture management with intramedullary nailing that was reviewed on this podcast last year. And then we'll finish up with a review of what I think is a really important article that especially residents and really all practitioners should review over the AAOS Clinical Practice Guideline, Management of Acute Compartment Syndrome, which was a really well-written article with three vignettes of management of compartment syndrome and how they apply the clinical practice guidelines in those scenarios. However, before we go any further, as we do every month, we want to remind you that we have a new sponsor this month, which is Modernizing Medicine. This podcast is brought to you by Modernizing Medicine, helping orthopedic practices fight burnout and connect with patients. Modernizing Medicine offers an orthopedic-specific suite of healthcare IT solutions, including the number one ortho-specific EHR system, EMA, practice management, billing services, analytics, patient engagement tools like telehealth, and more. To see a two-minute demo of all of the services that ModMed has to provide, visit modmed.com/orthopod. That's modmed.com/orthopod. All right, let's get started. All right, so the first article we want to briefly review with you this month is from the January 15th edition of the Yellow Journal, and it is an article titled Demographics and Clinical Presentation of Early Stage Leg Calf Perthes Disease, which many of us know as Perthes Disease, a Prospective Multicenter International Study, written by Dr. Jennifer Lane and colleagues on behalf of the International Perthes Study Group. So really, this is a really well-done international study where multiple centers in multiple countries on multiple continents enrolled patients who were identified with Perthes disease. Classically, children with Perthes disease have been described as small, thin, high-energy children who present with a painless limp. However, as the article references, recent research has shown that this may not always be the case for how these children present. So the purpose of their study was to determine the demographic and clinical features of children presenting in the early stages of Perthes disease with an international multicenter cohort. Children from the ages of 6 to 10, all in the early stages, modified Waldenstrom stage 1 to 2A, were enrolled in a prospective multicenter study across multiple continents and countries. At presentation, demographic and clinical data were analyzed, and in the United States and India, body mass index percentiles were determined using their country-specific growth charts. These were the two countries with the largest enrollment. Overall, 209 children from 25 centers across six countries were enrolled. 84% of these children actually presented with pain, with or without a limp. The average pain score presentation was 3 on a scale of 0 to 9, and 63% of these children actually were using pain medication at the time that they presented. Of these children, 65% required medication more than once per week. 30% of these children actually were missing school due to the pain in the month prior to their presentation, and of those, 74% missed at least one day of school out of the week. 29% of children from the United States and 20% of children from India were overweight or obese. Also, 19% reported household smoking, as secondhand smoke is one of the epidemiologic factors that has been associated with Perthes disease. So I think that this is a really fascinating article, not just in the fact that it's really well done and obviously has a huge area that it covers being an international multi-cohort study, as what they reference as the geographically broadest perspective report on the demographic presentation of Perthes disease, at least in the early stages of the disease. What's interesting is that the picture that this study paints isn't really the classical picture of how Perthes children are thought to present, thinking that they would be thin children who present with a painless limp, as actually most of these children presented initially due to pain, and only 15% met that description of the painless limp. Also, over half of these children were already taking pain medication, and a third were already missing a day of school per month. So this certainly doesn't always fit the classification of a painless limp child who is thin. This is shown in the high prevalence of overweight and obese children in the cohort, with 30% of United States children and 20% of children from India qualifying as overweight or obese. This is similar to the rates published for pediatric cohorts in the United States and India in previous studies. So perhaps more than anything, what this study helps us to do is enlighten ourselves that the clinical picture of early Perthes disease may be more impactful on these children than we realize, and that maybe the thin child with the painless limp is not necessarily the early Perthes kid we should be looking out for. So hopefully this is something we can all keep our eyes peeled for and hopefully make a difference in these kids' clinical outcomes. The next article we'll review this month is actually kind of a corollary to a previous article that was reviewed by my predecessor, Dr. Andy Jensen, with Dr. Christopher Lee, who wrote both of the articles concerning staying out of trouble with intramedullary nailing of distal tibia fractures, which is featured in the January 15th edition of the Yellow Journal. Dr. Jensen and Dr. Lee had a really great discussion months ago on this exact podcast concerning treatment of proximal tibia fractures with intramedullary nailing and tips and tricks on how to stay out of trouble. So this is Dr. Lee and colleagues' follow-up to that with tips and tricks on staying out of trouble with intramedullary nailing of distal tibia fractures. We obviously want to refer the readers back to the article for all of the great illustrations and intraoperative pictures that Dr. Lee and his colleagues provide. However, we will try to hit some of the high points. I think one of the most important things that Dr. Lee hits on is the importance of preoperative planning with these injuries. You know, more of these injuries are being treated with intramedullary nails than previously. However, things that we have to identify is the incidence of periarticular injuries that are associated with these distal tibia fractures, specifically posterior malleolus fractures, or any other injuries that may extend into the ankle joint. He also enlightens us that we should be aware of fractures with large intercalary fragments, which may allow the fracture to fall into varus or valgus during reaming and maintain that malreduction during placement of our nail. He briefly touches on the number of distal interlocking screws that are needed, referencing a study by Muhammad et al. That 80% of non-unions in distal third tibial shaft fractures with intramedullary fixation only have one distal interlocking screw. Also, he references a study by Tornetta and De Giacomo that showed that two medial to lateral distal interlocking screws will maintain adequate stability to hold your reduction. However, the author's preference is to obtain a minimum of three distal interlocking screws with at least two orthogonal screws when possible. The authors note that the intramedullary rod treatment for distal tibia fractures can be eased with the semi-extended position without the use of a radiolucent triangle, which is needed in the infrapatellar technique. The authors state that this makes imaging much easier, as you don't have to obtain the tilt needed for orthogonal imaging when the leg is over a triangle, and it can also make reduction and maintaining your rotation easier than if the knee is flexed. Perhaps one of the most interesting points of this article is the discussion of the endpoint of your guide wire and then eventually your rod distal in the tibia. It was previously thought, and still is the belief of many, that the proper positioning for the terminal position of the nail is in the center of the talus on your AP x-ray and the center of the plafond on your lateral view. However, the authors propose that to avoid valgus malalignment, a terminal positioning of the nail in the coronal plane slightly lateral to midline of the talus and then slightly posterior to center on the lateral actually helps you avoid malalignment in distal tibia fractures. The authors go on to recommend several techniques to reduce and maintain alignment of fractures during reaming and placement of your nail, such as percutaneous clamping, which can be done with small poke holes sliding the clamp around the fracture. And this is demonstrated in a few intraoperative and technique pictures within the article. They also go on to discuss blocking wires and screws. As we all know, the proper placement for a blocking wire screw is in the concavity of our deformity, which will force the rod into the part of the bone that we want it to be in. However, a thing that we may not think about is how the wire or screw that we put in will interact with the reamer. So they give some nice tips, such as putting a clamp at the skin to prevent posterior translation of a wire, as well as the fact that if you're going to use a blocking wire, a wire of at least 2 millimeters will stand up to a reamer, whereas a smaller wire may bend or break. Also, one of the more interesting discussion points in the article talks about fibular fixation. The authors discuss that it is their preferred approach to avoid fixation of the distal fibula when using intramedullary fixation on fractures of the distal tibia. However, they do recognize that all distal tibia fractures will need to undergo an external rotation stress exam because repairing the distal fibula may be necessary if the ankle demonstrates instability after intramedullary fixation of the distal tibia is obtained, as it does with an unstable ankle fracture. The authors also state that fibular fixation can potentially help achieve improved reduction of the distal tibia in select challenging patterns such as the ones noted in Figure 7 in the paper. They note that minimally invasive options are available, such as placing a guide wire for a rod up the fibula, or using an elastic nail, or even long screws to obtain fixation in the distal fibula. Overall, this is a really fantastic technique guide that all of us should keep in our back pocket, and certainly keep in mind the next time we encounter one of these difficult distal third tibial shaft fractures. The final article that we'll give a recommendation for, as much as we'll give a review of, is an article titled AAOS Clinical Practice Guideline, Management of Acute Compartment Syndrome, which was featured in the January 1st edition of the Yellow Journal, written by Dr. Marcus Coe and colleagues. This is certainly a useful tool for all of us, but most certainly for residents who may be listening, as it uses a vignette description of how to use and apply the ACS Clinical Practice Guidelines for Management of Compartment Syndrome. The three cases given are a male involved in a high-speed motor vehicle accident who sustains a highly comminuted proximal tibia fracture. They also give us a presentation of a middle-aged male who is found down after falling off of a ladder with swelling of his forearm and is obtunded and unable to give an exam. And they also give an example of a younger female who was found unresponsive with concern for gluteal compartment syndrome with late neurovascular changes and how to manage it. We won't go into each vignette specifically, but I will state that reading through the vignettes and noting how each practitioner in each case applies the clinical practice guidelines certainly makes more sense than just reading through the guidelines themselves. The example I will give is of the last vignette that we touched on, which is a young female who was found unresponsive by her roommates, who last saw her 36 hours ago in their house. She presents with tightness in her buttocks and thigh, and there was concern for compartment syndrome, so the orthopedic surgeon was consulted. On her exam, she can dorsiflex and plantar flex her ankle on the contralateral side, but not on the affected side. She also states that she cannot feel light touch to the plantar and dorsal aspect of her foot. Her buttocks and lateral thigh are tense. However, she does have a palpable pulse at her dorsalis pedis and her posterior tibial pulse. The authors give an illustration of how you can use the clinical practice guidelines in one case in that the orthopedic surgeon is concerned that the patient may have a late presenting compartment syndrome, although her CPK is downtrending, based on the consensus statement of the clinical practice guidelines that there's not enough evidence to support using biomarkers to assist in clinical decision making in this scenario. They also reference another clinical practice guideline which the practitioner uses that is another consensus statement that compartment pressure monitoring does not provide useful information in late presenting compartment syndrome when the practitioner chooses not to check compartment pressures in the patient's buttock and thigh. Ultimately, the surgeon takes into account one of the final clinical practice guidelines, which is a consensus statement that fasciotomy is not indicated in an adult with signs of irreversible intracompartmental damage and a late presenting compartment syndrome, as it does increase risk of infection and multiple unnecessary surgeries. And after a discussion with the family, he uses this information to ultimately decide not to pursue a fasciotomy. So I think ultimately what this article does is gives us real-life scenarios of how to apply the clinical practice guidelines for management of compartment syndrome, which is certainly something that we should all know, but especially for residents, applying them in real life scenarios may not be as easy to imagine. So I think overall, this is an article that all of us should put into our file and be able to reference back to when we get into these types of situations. So Happy New Year, everybody. Thank you for jumping back on to JOS Unplugged with us this month. We're pleased to welcome on to the podcast this month Dr. Brian Lau from Duke University, who wrote what I think is an awesome kind of review article of the evolution in surgical management of ankle instability in athletes, which was fascinating to me, and I think you're going to find it interesting as well with our conversation today. So Dr. Lau, thank you for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me. Appreciate it, Corey.
Yeah, absolutely. So as we always kind of do, we'll just kind of give you a few minutes to tell us a little bit about yourself, your background and your training, and kind of what your practice entails these days.
Well, yeah. So as you mentioned, I'm here at Duke University as one of the team physicians here, and on faculty as one of the professors here. And you know, through as a team physician, seeing all of our student athletes here. My training is a little bit unique. I actually started off as a radiologist, so I have some background in imaging, but then went on to orthopedics and doing a sports medicine fellowship here at Duke, but then doing a extra 6 months in foot and ankle with a particular interest in sports foot and ankle. So having kind of a second fellowship there in foot and ankle on top of my sports medicine fellowship. And my practice now consists mostly of sports injuries of the shoulder, knee, as well as the foot and ankle. So kind of a little bit well-rounded in those areas and mostly with instability in all those joints. So shoulder instability, knee instability, as well as ankle instability is a large part of my practice right now. Yeah, so it's a little bit of where I'm at and patients that I see.
Fantastic. Yeah, I think, you know, it's an evolving field, I think, in how we manage these athletes. And that's why part of why I think your article and a lot of this, you know, literature that comes out about how we treat athletes differently is fascinating. We always ask, but I'm especially curious in this case, kind of what the impetus for this specific article with your co-authors was and kind of how you guys came about the idea to tell us about how we're treating ankle instability in athletes differently these days.
Well, I think it started off as, you know, we're seeing more and more of these foot and ankle injuries in sports, particularly of the change in turf and some of the rule changes in terms of in football, particularly with, you know, protecting the head injuries, people hitting lower. And so we're seeing more and more foot and ankle injuries. And it's becoming a more and more commonly discussed topic in a lot of our meetings, and which is actually what the impetus kind of for this paper was we were asked to put together an instructional course lecture for AOSSM to teach the membership there a little bit more about how to manage ankle instability in our athletes. And from that meeting with my co-authors, we all had different parts we were discussing there. And after that meeting, through all the discussions and conversations with the people who came to that course, felt like, you know, there's actually a lot of information that has changed in the way we manage these injuries. And, you know, thought it would be good to put together a review, disseminate that information a little bit and put it all in one place. And so that was kind of where that came from. And it's been very educational for us too, to hear what, you know, from just talking to each other, but also just reviewing the literature and everything else too. Just more and more people asking us about it. And so we thought we'd put that information out there.
No, that's fantastic. And I think that, you know, this is a lot of times where we find some of the, you know, the most useful knowledge that gets compiled is when we have, you know, people such as you who are experts in the field and sports medicine, specifically foot and ankle, as well as your co-authors, and people are come together and kind of synthesize all this, you know, information that's kind of in the nebulous of what is the field of orthopedics and things that are kind of floating around. So, you know, I love what the Yellow Journal does with a lot of these review articles where we just consolidate a lot of this information that, you know, you can get it by hearsay or conversations at meetings or whatever the case, but to be able to consolidate the information into one place is fantastic. So we'll jump right into it. And I think that the way you guys set up the article, and we always like to refer back, so this will actually be in the January 1st edition of the Yellow Journal for those who are looking for the article. And so we always refer back, but I think the way you set it up is nice in that you start where we meet all of these athletes, which is either on the field of play or once they come into your office after their injury. And so just briefly, I was wondering if you could touch on pearls from your physical exam that you've picked up on over the years or you've learned from some of your colleagues about things you're looking for on the physical exam of these athletes with ankle instability now that you maybe haven't always been.
I think the key for this is still kind of the history is the biggest part. You know, there's, you know, really kind of two ways to think of instability. It's like the mechanical instability, which is the patient is slipping out, they're having lots and lots of ankle sprains. You see them rolling their ankle. you know, the standard physical exam tests of the anterior drawer, Taylor tilt, standard things that we all learn about as we're reading and in residency. That's the obvious one. It's the little things where, you know, there's functional instability where patients may not be so grossly unstable, but they're describing this feeling of their ankle giving out. When they're walking on uneven ground, maybe they feel like it gives out. They have difficulty of cutting and turning. They just feel uncomfortable. They may not even be sharp pain. And so that's kind of the history part of it. And then your exam, you know, the big thing is doing those standard tests and really comparing it to the contralateral side. And for a lot of people, they can feel very loose, but then the other side is loose too. And that could just be kind of what their standard is. So it's always really important to make sure you compare the contralateral side. And similar to our shoulder instability patients, you want to get a general sense of their overall laxity in their body as well, just to, you know, give yourself a little bit of sense of maybe this person's like hyperlax and this is just normal for them. The main thing really is getting that history with them. And this ankle instability, and what we talk about in this journal, is more people not as they walk off the field, but really after you give them a, you know, 7 to 10 days to kind of cool down from that initial sprain and getting a little bit better of an exam. So that's really the history, and then giving them some time, you know, from their initial injury to get a sense if they're continuing to have symptoms.
Gotcha. And so the next point you touch on, I think, is where a lot of people are going to want to know what you do specifically, as well as some of your colleagues, which is, say, a football player comes to you after the season and he describes multiple ankle sprains maybe during the season, and now he's trying to play basketball and he feels like his ankle is unstable. So as far as your workup with imaging, and I think your opinion is specifically going to be, you know, valued as the fact that you have a background in radiology as well. Where are you going with imaging on these kids? Is it stress radiographs for everybody? Is it an MRI for everybody? And if so, kind of what do you find valuable from those scans?
So I typically will get an MRI and so on a patient like you're describing there. Now, the physical exam on someone like you're describing is pretty clear. And you make sure you palpate, you know, the ATFL. You can palpate the deltoid, the medial side, as well as up the syndesmosis to make sure there's not a syndesmosis component to it. But the exam, you know, I feel comfortable, you know, I do this very frequently, like several times a day, this anterior drawer and anterior tilt. So I have a good sense of how that feels. Now, a lot of trainees have trouble with that. And so that's where I think that if you're not familiar with how it feels, doing the stress radiographs can be helpful. So if you have a fluoro machine in your office, doing the stress radiographs to see for that, measuring that widening and the subluxations can be very useful. But for me, I'm typically going to MRI, and it's actually not necessarily to confirm the ligamentous injury, if my exam is confirming that, is to make sure that there's not something else that's going on. So when these patients continue to have this instability for 3, 4, or 5 months, you want to make sure you're not missing some kind of osteochondral lesion in particular, because if you are planning on taking them for surgery, you want to be prepared in case you need to do something with that. So that's typically how I'm doing, you know, in terms of my advanced imaging for that. I don't typically do stress radiographs, but I do find them very helpful. I know trainees that come through my clinic, it's really good for them to visualize what they're doing exactly on their anterior drawer, their Taylor tilt. And so that can definitely be useful too.
And I think that's a great pearl, because I know a lot of our listeners are maybe not necessarily people who see these injuries all day, every day, maybe like you do. And so that's a great point of, if you're not as comfortable with your physical exam, or if there's, you know, if it's equivocal, a stress radiograph, you know, it can be valuable in that situation. And so I think another important point you point out is concomitant injuries such as osteochondral injuries and syndesmotic injuries. And so that kind of leads us to our next point, which is exactly where you go next in the article, which is arthroscopy at the time of surgery. So we've moved on, this athlete's come in our office and we've diagnosed them with ankle instability. And so now we're going to the operating room. Can you just talk a little bit about how your use of ankle arthroscopy maybe has changed, and what setting you're using it in? Is it in every one of these cases or certain cases? And just give us an idea of what we should be doing as far as how we should be handling scoping these ankles.
So I would say that for me, I've kind of evolved to using ankle arthroscopy for every time I do something like this. So anytime I go in for ankle instability, I'm always scoping. My co-authors and a lot of people who treat this very frequently are using it more and more. And basically, I think there's a consensus that most of us using it all the time when we do these lateral ankle instability cases. One, because it allows us to assess for any kind of impingement, which can be associated with ankle instability, particularly in the lateral gutter. If you've had a prior injury there, you can develop scar tissue, you can develop some fibrosis in that area. And then breeding that at the same time can be very useful. It allows you to assess the cartilage. You can look at the syndesmosis. You can look at the deltoid. can do some arthroscopic evaluations, not just visually, but also with testing of a drive-through sign, which can either be done with putting in a 3-5 shaver into the joint space on the medial side or through the syndesmosis, or putting the camera through that, whichever you prefer, and just trying to see whether or not it gaps opens, or if you're able to do it, would indicate more of a injury to the syndesmosis and the deltoid as a way to kind of confirm your physical exam. And so I'm using it all the time. I'm comfortable doing it. And I understand that not everyone, scopes ankles, but when you get sufficient at it and you're able to do it, it doesn't take very long. And I think that's the biggest concern, because some people are concerned that you put the scope in, you're struggling a little bit. It may take a little bit longer than you anticipate. You might lose some tissue planes because some of your fluid may egress to your surgical field. So now your tissue plane's a little bit off. But I think there was a lot of value in putting that scope in, just making sure you're not missing something so that you can address that at the same time. And or if they have a small chondral lesion, maybe you don't do anything about it, but then you're saying, oh, the patient's now describing afterwards are still having some pain, that can give you a source of maybe it's from that.
Yeah, I think that's great. And I think the way it was described to me by one of my mentors about, using the scope is it's just another data point, right? And I feel like, especially with these athletes who are so keen on everything that's different from one ankle to the next, or, something that, I usually can cut and do this and now I can't quite do it the same. I think you're right in that it just gives us more data points to guide our treatment and to guide our decision-making. And I think that's a great point to use the arthroscope and gain information and make, diagnoses of something you're looking at. I think that's super valuable. So I think that that's kind of the appetizer, if you will. So we'll get into the meat of it, which I think was very well written, talking about the actual repair. So lateral ankle instability, the ligaments are torn, like you said, the ATFL. And so we're getting ready to fix these. And so the article discusses the previous way that these were classically fixed through intraosseous bone tunnels. And so now you talk about that we're using suture anchors, that a lot of times now we're augmenting this with suture tape. And so if you could briefly just walk us through kind of how you started out fixing these, and then maybe how you're fixing these now and where you see the value with the repair using the anchors, and then in what cases you are using the suture tape to augment your repair.
The historic way of fixing this before there were suture anchors was, like you mentioned, through the bone tunnels and putting suture through these bone tunnels and tying everything back. And that does very, very well. And I've done that, and patients do very well. I think in terms of where the benefit of the suture anchor is that it's more reproducible. You tend to not have to make as big of a dissection because you're able to put in through a smaller hole through your incision. People who are in sports medicine were very familiar with how to use anchors. And it's same as in the shoulder, where we used to use bone tunnels, and now we use anchors. We have transosseous approaches in the shoulder. And so we're very comfortable using that as sports medicine surgeons. And the other thing is that for people who don't do it as frequently, it is also a lot easier and reproducible than necessarily putting bone tunnels if you're not as familiar doing the bone tunnels. So I think that's definitely the value in the suture anchors. Now, the downside, which several authors will have published about, is that there is an additional cost to it. So, obviously anchors are much more expensive than making a bone tunnel and tying suture through it, but it is much quicker. So even though the initial cost of the implant is higher in terms of your surgical time, you're probably, cutting down at least a good 15, 20 minutes from having to make these bone tunnels. Specifically, if you haven't done bone tunnels very frequently, it's going to take you a lot longer to do that. You can have a smaller incision so that can help with healing afterwards and rehab, less dissection. Then in terms of the suture tape, the trade name that a lot of people use is internal brace, but it really is just this high molecular fiber that we use. And the concept behind it is not really to necessarily, repair the ATFL, but to serve more as a check ring, as a way like a seatbelt. So, your standard repair is what's holding the ligament in place. And then say the person has a little bit of too much, rolls your ankle a little bit, that fiber tape as a way to kind of just as an extra protection so you don't pull off your repair in that early postoperative period. In terms of when I use that, I'm not using that for all my patients. I'm actually using that for, less than, 15% of the time. And really is for patients who are hyperlax. So, on the generalized laxity throughout their body, just really, really lax, as a way to help kind of protect that, repair a little bit more. Patients are recurrent, so now this is a revision case, I will use it. And those are kind of the main, times I'm using it. I'm not using it for my primary cases often. really just for those revisions and for those patients who are really, really like hyperlax, you know, Baton scores that are at least a 7 or above. So that's kind of how we're using the suture anchors most of it, and when we're using that kind of fiber tape.
Gotcha. So I guess a concern, you know, that some people have with the use of these internal braces, as you said, is the trade name or the suture tape augmentation is, you know, there's discussion in the knee world of internal bracing, the ACL, if you pull it too tight, leads to stress shielding, which could, you know, theoretically inhibit healing of your graft into your tunnels. And you mentioned in your article that there's been cases described specifically in one study where the people who had suture tape augmentation had decreased dorsiflexion compared with their contralateral side. So just as a technical pearl, if you are augmenting your repair with suture tape, what thought are you giving to undue tension on that internal brace or to overconstraining the ankle?
Yeah. So when you're putting in that, you know, internal brace, the key is to make sure while you're tensioning it, so you're putting in that final anchor, that you have a freer in between the underneath that internal brace. And so that when you're tightening it down, that prevents you from over tightening it. So it really should serve as a seatbelt. So if you think about when you're in a car, when you're sitting there and just driving, that seatbelt isn't pushing up against your chest. But when something happens and you get suddenly jolted forward, it locks and it serves as that protection. And so the same idea here is that while you're sitting there in a normal movement of your ankle, pulling on that tissue shouldn't be stress shielding it at all. But if you have that, you know, forceful inversion injury, it can serve as that seatbelt and really catch to prevent it from rolling too much. And that's the way you should really think about it. Not as a way to, you know, tighten it as tight as you can and to really constrain, because that's when you get the over constraint and the problems if that comes with that.
The way you describe it as a seatbelt is a picture we should all kind of put into our head, right? In that the internal brace should be something that at a maximal point of stress where you could potentially stretch or re-injure your ligaments, the internal brace protects you. But through normal range of motion, it really should just be your ligaments providing the support. Is that kind of what we're getting at?
Yep, that's exactly right.
Gotcha. Yeah, and I think you described that really well. So I guess the next point we go to then, if we talk about we're using this as a seatbelt and to protect our repair from, say, an inversion that may happen at the ankle early in the healing process is, you know, we're talking about athletes, right? So you say this at the end of your article, and I think that it's the most important point really with dealing with athletes is return to play. So I would just ask, in managing these instability cases, how have you changed your weight bearing? How have you changed your rehab process and return to play? And has the augmentation with suture tape or any of your new techniques been able to accelerate that as we've kind of progressed through the past couple of years?
So I think, you know, most, if you poll a bunch of people who do a lot of these surgeries, and there's like a study group that does that, most of us still are restricting some form for at least 2 weeks. So whether that's a boot or a splint, we're kind of protecting their weight bearing for at least 2 weeks. But then within 2 weeks, most people are, you know, in terms of an isolated lateral, you know, stabilization, are having people move very quickly and early. So within 2 weeks. Now that changes if you have to do something with a deltoid, a syndesmosis, and some people, I personally will extend their protective weight bearing for a full month. But within 2 weeks, I'm normally getting them moving and rehabbing quickly. And that's, you know, functional rehab, balance, proprioception, and, you know, strengthening and range of motion. And when I use the internal brace, as I mentioned, I'm normally doing it in revision cases or patients who are super, you know, hyperlax. So I'm not really changing that protocol. Now, there are people out there who are using internal brace and they're actually moving people earlier. So, you know, maybe only a few days of protective weight bearing and then moving them earlier because they feel that that internal brace is, in a way, as I, you know, kind of said before, using that seatbelt. So preventing them from over-stressing that repair. So there are people who will try to push the envelope and get people to move earlier by putting that internal brace on every one of their patients. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I'm trying to get more and more comfortable with turning the internal brace, and I feel very good about my standard repair, that I feel like it's not necessarily needed. Now, I know the biomechanical data will show that it's stronger, which it is. I mean, you're putting something extra in there, so it's going to be stronger. But with the standard repair, I do feel comfortable, and I feel like I'm already moved them pretty quickly that don't really necessarily need that extra, you know, to push them any further. And for me, those first 2 weeks is really to kind of allow that incision to heal and want that to heal before they really start getting the move too much.
Gotcha. Yeah. And I think that it really is a great point you make that the internal brace or the augmentation of your repair a lot of times should be a check rein that we use to
protect the repair, but maybe not a crutch that we lean on to allow us to do something we wouldn't normally do, right? And I know that you mentioned we're all progressing in how we get these athletes, whether it's a weekend warrior or like the guys you take care of that are, you know, elite college or professional athletes. No matter the case, we should be comfortable with our repair as it is, right? And not feel like we need anything to augment it to improve our repair, but, you know, not do anything we're uncomfortable with as far as rehabilitation, just because we put another piece of suture and, you know, a couple anchors in there. I think that that's a really good point. The last thing I wanted to touch on, because if I'm not careful, we'll end up talking all day about this stuff. Like I said, I really enjoy talking about this, is return to sport. So if you could touch briefly on how we've been able to improve maybe our return to sport with these athletes, with how we've evolved and how we treat them, and just some closing comments on where you think the continued evolution of treatment of ankle instability is headed and how your practice has changed.
Well, I think one of the things that we've progressed in terms of rehab and return to play is that we're letting people do things earlier. So, you know, right around 2 weeks, we're already starting their rehab. By 4 weeks in a standard repair, we're already starting to let them do some sport-specific exercises, doing some early cutting and stuff. Now, you know, when we say they're cleared to return to train, that's not necessarily return to play. But, you know, in 4 weeks, they're starting to, you know, get back with their trainers, doing some more sport-specific stuff. And if they continue to do well, they can be back in play within two and a half months on the field at game time. And so I think that it's really the understanding of the importance of the proprioception and balance, just the same way when we treat ankle sprains non-operatively, the importance of that early rehab and being able to get people back while still allowing time for that tissue to heal in those first couple of weeks. So I think more and more people are starting to, you know, get people back earlier. You know, the average time, there was a study that was put out when that, you know, in terms of a systematic review, said the average time is around 4 months returning back to play. So it really varies. And it does depend on if there's a concomitant injuries, the deltoid or the syndesmosis that delays things a little bit. But I think for me, most of my patients are getting back around the 2, 2.5 months, maybe 3 months on average. But it's definitely a conversation with the patient to have and their trainers. And it's going to be how comfortable they are when they do. They feel like they're back to where they can cut and turn and protect themselves. So that's kind of the big thing. Where I think, you know, ankle instability and treatment of ankle instability is going is that there's more and more discussion about all arthroscopic techniques, which is, you know, for me as a sports surgeon, seems like a natural progression. We like to do as many things as possible with smaller incisions. And if we think kind of to the shoulder instability, most of these were treated open, if open, you know, labral repairs, open capsular shifts. And then as you get more and more comfortable with the scope, now it's really a standard to do an arthroscopic repair in like a first time dislocator or even a second time dislocator with isolated labral pathology. There are many trainees now who've never seen an open approach to the shoulder. And why is that? It's because we got more comfortable with the scope, where patients did well with just an arthroscopic procedure. And I kind of feel like we're at that crossroads right now with ankle instability as well. Now we're getting more comfortable with doing arthroscopy. Most of us are doing arthroscopy all the time anyways with these ankle instability patients. So we've already got the scope in there. We're comfortable putting anchors in through the scope. For most of us who do shoulders, that's how we do it. So we're getting comfortable with it. And some of these techniques that have come out of Dr. Acevedo and Dr. Mangone, the two of them have really put a lot of papers out there describing these different safe zones you can use to do, you know, pass your sutures from outside in, and, you know, really minimizing the amount of dissection and sutures you have to do. So I think that's kind of probably, you know, what I would think would be where this ankle instability goes as people get more comfortable with doing these as an arthroscopic repair. I'd be interested to see how more people do it. My standard is still an open approach, especially my elite athletes. Maybe my weekend warriors who are not quite elite, but still very active, will consider doing arthroscopic and obviously have that discussion with the patient. But those are right now where my kind of indications for it. But as I get more and more comfortable and get more experience of how those patients do long term, I can definitely see myself pushing the envelope and trying that in a younger, more high level athlete too.
That is fantastic. Again, pointing back to the article, there's a really nice description of the all arthroscopic technique that Dr. Lau discusses. There's a really nice diagram that shows the safe zone he discusses. And so we're obviously limited by time. I'd love to, you know, take 30 minutes and talk through that whole technique, but we'll point the listeners back to the article for the description of that. And I think you touch on another really important point through all of this, which kind of summarizes this nicely. You know, our interview last month with Dr. Proby from Texas was about shared decision making. And I think that you point out a really important point, which is the weekend warrior athlete who is not necessarily a college or a professional athlete who comes to you for management of this injury. It is a discussion, right, of what we're going to do and how we're going to do it and how quickly we're going to get back to play. And, you know, it may be that for somebody trying to hustle back to be able to, you know, do that triathlon in 8 weeks may be a really big deal. And for other people, it may be that they have the full 4 months to take time and do it the right way that, like, you know, like you'd be more comfortable with. But it is always a discussion of risk and benefits with the patient. And I'm glad you said that to point it out, because we always stress that in each practitioner's hands, we treat these things differently. But Dr. Lau, I think that was a fascinating description. I think the article is really well written, and we encourage all of our listeners to go back and check it out. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's great discussion, and I really enjoyed the podcast.
Well, that is all we have for this month. We want to thank again all of our authors who contributed to the January 1st and January 15th editions of the Yellow Journal. And we especially want to thank Dr. Lau for coming on and providing his insights on ankle instability and managing those in athletes. We hope you enjoyed the article, and we look forward to speaking with you again next month. We hope everyone's New Year's off to a happy and healthy start, and we will talk to you soon. See you next month.